Hello and welcome to that one little corner of the internet we call the DieCast. I'm Josh Veal. Joining me here, as always, is Seamus Young, whom I've just been informed is actually not a chamois or a towel.
That is correct.
Also here is Rutskarn, whom we tolerate only because he's the only funny person.
Also because I actually am a chamois and towel and we spill a lot of stuff.
Well, yeah, it's always nice to have dual-purpose funny people.
And Campster.
Campster is also here.
Yeah, I apologize for the urine smell, but I mean, I am here.
Well, you know, I think I was happier when I didn't know that you had anything to do with that.
Well, I didn't. The dog peed in the backpack, and just don't question
it. Oh, yeah, sure, okay. Yeah, we totally believe you, Chris. Uh-huh. So, today, we have a great show for you that does not involve chamois or urine smells, because that would be weird. So let's go ahead and start off why don't we start off with you, Seamus? How have you been this week? What have you been doing?
What's the happy
I am fine. I don't have a lot to report this week because I've just been programming. And, of course, I'm already writing about that. So everybody's already sick to death about hearing about that. And so I haven't even been playing a lot of video games other than Minecraft. So basically nothing to report. Can I do that? Can I just say nothing
to
report?
Well, what have you been doing in Minecraft? Did you hear about their new update that's changing all the biomes around? I mean, not that you're probably already running some biome mod that adds, like, fucking space or something, so I guess that's not such a big deal for you.
No, I'm still running Tekkit Lite, and it's like 6 months or 9 months out of date with the main release.
That's the inevitable end of Minecraft, right? I didn't mean to cut you off there. You know that that's the inevitable end of Minecraft when they add Kerbal Space Program style stuff?
No, I was just picturing it as like an actual biome, like you're walking through a jungle and then there's the void of space for like, and then on the other side of that there's an ice biome.
Yeah, the latest version of Tekkit, which I am not running, I'm running Tekkit Lite, but the latest version of Tekkit does have some sort of space program thing going. I don't know if you can go to the moon or not, but it's something like that. And I'm not running that. And I'm
like, how?
Yeah, I don't know.
How does any, like, they must have like a portal to some, like, they must have reworked the Nether or some, or the End or something, because like, there's no way you could change the Minecraft maps to add like a massive third dimension to it. Like, you only have 256 slots.
Yeah, but can you get Mass Effect costumes? Because that's an Xbox exclusive.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So, that's what I'm doing, is I was playing a 9-month-old version of Minecraft with my son, who himself has been doing this weird archaeological thing. Apparently there's a launcher that lets you easily step back through any version of Minecraft, and so he went back all the way to the early alphas and began, like, playing through each release in order and looking at the features a little bit at a time. He's 11.
Isn't that actually the default launcher now?
I don't know. This is some other thing in that you can jump back and forth between, like, you can roll back to previous versions, which I don't, like, think the main launcher.
I think they made that an official feature now. I don't know. I haven't played Minecraft in like 2 years, so.
Yeah.
Well, aside from that brief thing where I played it for a month with the Tekkit mod.
Yeah, but I think that was an interesting project, was to basically create a world and then kind of roll forward through all the releases and see things get added. Like, go through the entire Minecraft development cycle in 2 days and see it all take shape. It's kind of an interesting project.
Also, here's the thing. I fell off the Minecraft wagon about 2 years ago, two full calendar years. So that would be a useful feature for me in the same sense that, like, slight spoiler warning for Captain America, the First Avenger, but you know how, like, at the end of it, he wakes up, like, in the room that looks like the 1940s? But, you know, it's actually outside, it's Times Square and, like, super future technology. That would be me. I'd be waking up in a base that looked like my base with everything still working, all the biomes correct, and then I'd be like, okay, let's take one step forward. And then, like, 56 updates later, I'd be like, okay, now I'm a spaceman, but at least I understand why.
So you're saying you're Rumpelstiltskin.
I am Minecraft Rumpelstiltskin. I stumble out like, what year is it? Like, here's the thing. I was in a mall recently, and Minecraft merch is everywhere. And, like, next to the Minecraft sword and Minecraft pickaxes, they have, like, foam Minecraft guns. Like, Minecraft pistols.
That's just weird.
And I was like, is that an actual thing now? Have we reached gunpowder?
I am amazed at how much money this game has made. It is... I think it is dwarfing even the really big AAA releases. Like, you have to get into, like, World of Warcraft before you can top Minecraft money. Just on sales alone, even if you assume that they all sold for, like, $15 a pop, if you look at the number of sales, I forget what it is, but I worked it out the other day, and I think it came to, like, $500 million. Just in sales, that's not merchandising.
Yeah, it's really reaching Angry Birds level of saturation, almost.
Yeah.
So, I'm running the math now, according to the website. They have sold, and this is just PC only, 12 million copies and change, but whatever. Table napkin math. And at 12 million copies times $15 a copy, which I know they sold it for different prices, but average out to $15 a copy, you end up with $180 million on the PC alone in raw revenue. $180 million.
With and the thing virtually is, no marketing and virtually no budget.
This all sold really
like,
well.
What, 30 people?
Yeah, this sold this really point. Well for mobile and for Xbox.
Right. You've got all the sales for the other platforms. And, yeah. It just comes to so much money. So much money.
I'm looking at the Minecraft website, and I'm noticing there's a Facebook tab, and Seamus Young has liked Minecraft.
Isn't Facebook creepy as hell?
Yes. Also, Jarenth liked it, and some other random people.
Oh, hey, three people
some
liked
other
it.
Random people, too. That's great.
Is Minecraft any good? Yeah, some random people liked it. Okay.
Also, 7 million
like
people on
Twitter
Facebook
emails
can't be wrong.
That I get. It's like those annoying Twitter emails that I get like every 2 weeks, even though I haven't used Twitter in like 2 years. It's like, oh, do you know such and such and such and such on Twitter? And it's just like random people that are following me or following Seamus or something.
You really should get on Twitter, Josh. It's the way the world communicates now. It's email
2.0. I should, but I worry that, like, if I were to really get into it, because, like, I stopped doing it because I started tweeting and I realized, holy shit, if I keep doing this, I am going to spend all of my time doing this and nothing else.
No, do it like I do it. Like, run TweetDeck, because my stupid in-browser thing stopped because their API is terrible. Run TweetDeck in the background while you work and just,
stuff
like...
is terrible anyway.
Yeah, but you know, run TweetDeck while you work and occasionally check it, and then come up with a snarky sentence or two, and then send that out to the world and have people, like, tell you you're an idiot. That's how Twitter works.
Yes. I mean, it really is, like, when you have snarky... It is... I actually have to be careful with Twitter, because every time I have something to say, it is always snarky, and if somebody were to follow me on Twitter, they would assume I'm just this horrible, snarky person that just, like, sneers at everything, but... You know, if you really like something, boy, I sure do enjoy this, doesn't make for an interesting tweet. So that never gets said.
Well, the thing...
Go ahead, Red Scroll.
I've actually been applying for some positions where, you know, the fact that I'm able to leverage Twitter in an effective fashion is relevant. So I actually have to face the prospect of an employer looking over, a potential employer, looking over my Twitter feed. And, yeah, actually, to be fair, like, the part-time job I have writing Unrest was actually given to me via Twitter. But, you know, I have to face the very real possibility that I'm putting down on a resume, like, you know, it has shown adeptness at utilizing social media such as Twitter for, and then they're going to, like, look over and they're going to see me calling Ben Kuchera Duck Hooch.
Isn't that kind of, yeah, like really scary in itself, though, that
is it, though?
You have all this stuff about you that you've said on the internet now forever. I mean, not to get, like, full Luddite on anyone, but like, the California school that recently, they just last week announced that they were going to spend, like, such and such $1 million to monitor all of their students' social media activities. I mean,
oh,
it's nuts.
That is... I disbelieve that will get anywhere.
I mean, you can get fired for a tweet now. It's crazy.
Well, that's why you just tweet snarky stuff. I mean, that's the thing that Seamus was saying, is that you only post things that are relatively harmless. Don't post everything that enters your head, but post, you know, things that, like, this link is stupid, and then just leave it at that. I've actually been told by people that follow me and also listen to this podcast and watch Aaron Signal and watch Spoiler Warning that I seem like a very different person on Twitter, and it's because I do, between the 140 character limit and the publicness of Twitter and also the sheer number of people you're broadcasting to at any given moment, you have to, yeah, monitor what you say. So most of what I say is pretty much just snark, inoffensive snark, but snark. It's like, this link is dumb, yeah, you guys, or this thing is stupid, you guys should all laugh at it, and that's see, it. I don't post, like, meaningful debates.
See, the thing is, Chris, I actually would not say that about your Twitter feed. I would say that your Twitter feed is ultimately more representative of how you sound on your show and on the Diecast than most people's are.
Yeah.
Like
you sound way different on the Diecast and Spoiler Warning, like, to me than you do on Aaron's Signal and Twitter.
That's it.
Yeah,
scripted.
Yeah, like, because when you're on Twitter, you know, you often are coming down against something, but you're still putting it fairly earnest, fairly, like, non-confrontational way, where you're expressing an opinion about it. Folksy. That's almost not a bad way of putting it. You're like a local politician who's sort of a nice guy, but who has opinions you would still get behind. That is your presence on Twitter.
And that is what Seamus is doing this week.
Yep, that's what I'm doing. Apparently, Twitter and, like, an hour of Minecraft. So, and I'm making a video game, sort of, but maybe not, so don't hold me to it. Yay.
Great. Cool. Wow, yeah, that was just the first thing that we talked about, wasn't it? Rutskarn. Rutswow. Nah, it doesn't really work. How are the happy haps?
I'm glad you asked, Bogo. Well, allow me to elaborate about the qualities and characteristics of my haps this week. It will shock and surprise you to learn that I have been playing video games. I just haven't been playing any video games that would merit a headline. This week I played two games. First game I played was, I actually picked up Thief Gold once again. The original Thief game for the PC. I had discontinued playing
it. You can't
buy
that game too many times.
Mm-hmm. I had discontinued playing the game about 5 months ago. Because the thing about Thief is, it subscribes to the school of game design from that era, where it was like, okay, if we just create, you know, a set of very simple systems and then we spend the rest of our time making these huge expansive environments and tons of missions, that's the best way to get our content across. And so, you know, Thief, it's like you've got only got a few modes of interaction, and you've got gadgets, but, you know, they do sort of set things. But then they give you very large environments to exercise that in, and then they give you lots of sort of emergent content where you're combining these things. You know, like an old, much larger version of Dishonored with no powers is the best way to describe it. Like, if Dishonored had, instead of powers and runes, it had just massive levels with tons of content. And yeah. I had actually jumped ship with Thief, because I've been playing on the expert level where, you know, you have to get all the stuff and you have to get all kinds of things. And there was a level which was just too hard for me. And it wasn't that I was having trouble sneaking around.
Which level was it?
It was the manor where you have to steal the Sword of Constantine. And I got the sword, no problem, and I got pretty much all the loot I had to, but I needed to find one specific thing, like I needed to find dirt on the guy who owns this giant maze puzzle manor, and I had no idea where he would keep it, and the level was so huge and so expansive and so easy to get lost in that I spent literally, I think, about 9 or 10 hours trying to find it. It was in the last place I'd think to look, and I sort of just stopped. And then I picked it up, and I cheated, and I looked at a walkthrough. And I didn't look up exactly where it was, but I looked up, like, which of the 10 main areas it was in. Like, it's outside in the massive garden zone, which is difficult to navigate. And eventually I managed to find it. Almost
by
accident.
We praise the really large, sprawling levels of games like Thief, but in retrospect, I think I kind of prefer, for interiors anyway, Dishonored smaller levels, because, you know, they weren't like small and claustrophobic enough to ever feel like there's just one path that you have to get to your goal, but they also didn't feel like you were running around a hedge maze dressed up as a mansion. Without any real logical flow to any of the rooms.
Okay, I will say that the fact that the manor was not laid out logically was absolutely the point. I won't really go into that. Partially because of spoilers and partially because I don't fully understand all the circumstances. Suffice it to say that the manor is supposed to be supernatural and sort of weird.
Right, okay. But even for manners, like, even if it wasn't, like, for other interior spaces in games, like, I remember playing, you know, games back in the late 90s, like, say, Jedi Knight, and just having these masses sprawling labyrinths of levels that just made no, like, internal logical sense.
Like, no, the worst...
Most buildings are laid out with, like, a central hub with, you know, hallways going off and spokes and whatnot, and in, like, a grid pattern, basically. And in most games at that time, it was just like, long hallway and a big branching, like, thing that resembles more like a neuron or a river tributary system.
Absolutely the worst offender at that was Daggerfall, because Daggerfall had these procedurally generated dungeons that were stupidly massive and stupidly complicated. And
it's kind of like,
I quit playing Daggerfall.
If you were to put a tagline on that game, wouldn't it just be stupidly massive?
Yeah, and
pointlessly
kind of,
massive.
Pointlessly massive, yes. It was big because it could be. Like, I actually was enjoying that game up to an extent when I tried it like a year ago. And I quit playing it because I was sent to a dungeon to kill, I think, either a certain orc or a certain amount of orcs. And I spent 4 hours in the dungeon and I never found an orc. And I never found the way forward and I never found the way back. It was absurdly sprawling. Should I wait until the dog stops barking?
No, I think it adds to the character of the urban Rutskarn neighborhood.
Okay, the dog will stop barking in a minute, or I could actually go stop it if it's a problem.
Oh, that sounded really dark. We could wait for it, or I could go
no,
stop.
No.
If you do, make sure to leave your microphone open so we can hear it.
The only thing you'd hear would be like, come here, Yuki, come here, Yuki.
Bark, 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 bark.
Yep!
Oh god, I love this dog is the problem. Like, this is a great dog that is like, lives in this house that is just such a sweetheart. Okay, he stopped. You can cut that out, John.
No, that, I like that. That's, thumbs up for that segment.
Have you noticed how often that happens, viewers? That, like, one of us says, oh, Josh, just cut that out, and Josh is like, no, that's part of the artistic vision. Anyway.
I believe that the best way to make fun of people is to let them make fun of themselves and then just not cut it when they tell you to.
The Sacha Baron Cohen myth.
Pretty much. I don't know who those people are.
Back to my story. So yeah, so that was Daggerfall. And for anybody who gets nostalgic about Daggerfall, I was actually on a website recently that predated Morrowind that was full of it was a Daggerfall fan site of all fan sites. It was just full of all kinds of walkthroughs and guides. And the guy it was such a labor of love. And the guy had a part where he was like enumerating like stuff he wants in Morrowind, and one of them was, guys, tone down the fucking dungeon. Like, it's not even like they didn't know better. They knew better. But anyway, back to Thief. The thing is, I don't think Thief suffers from that necessarily. Their levels are large, but they're very intuitive. It's like, oh, this is what the house would look like. This is what the massive system of tunnels under the house would look like. This is what the tavern attached to the massive system of tunnels would look like. This is what the street outside the tavern, outside the massive series of tunnels, outside the mansion would look like. But the thing that actually makes me aggravated is my own fault, which is that I have it on expert, which often asks you to find, oh yeah, there's one other thing, which is at a virtually random point in this massive map, and that ruins the experience.
I like picturing it like a Steve Jobs, like you've collected three different things and you know, snuck past 20 guards, and he comes out on stage and goes, one more thing, here's this, and it's this tiny little diamond, and he's like, it's buried somewhere in the house, good luck, sucker, and then he runs away.
You also need to find the nipple of infinite virtue. It's located under a cobblestone that looks... that is 2 degrees lighter than every other cobblestone. You need to right-click on it, it'll shift out of the way, you'll get the diamond, and you'll just let out this huge, just... oh, fucking, finally!
I'm usually down on Thief 3, or Deadly Shadows, or whatever they called it. But this is something I think they took kind of a step forward in Thief 3. Aside from the horrible, horrible level transitions that they were obliged to use in the game, I think that was probably the high point for having environments that made sense. I spent very little time lost in that game. I mean, it still wouldn't make perfect sense as a floor plan, but it made more sense than most games.
Yeah, again, I'm actually gonna go ahead and say I really liked Thief 2's large areas, and I would probably like it more if I didn't do this to myself and insist on playing on the hardest difficulty.
It is so tempting to do it. You're like, I love this game, and if I play it on hard, I'll get more of this game. So you turn the difficulty up, and then you realize, wow, this is really tedious, and I wish I had not done this.
It's like, I don't want to be a wuss. And now I've started playing it on expert difficulty, and I could stop playing it on expert at any moment.
But you don't. But you don't. I know just how that is.
Yeah. The other game,
It's even worse for me, because I feel like that when I play my Shogun 2 Let's Play on Legendary difficulty, and I'm thinking back to, like, 2011 when I started this, and I'm like, why did I select Legendary difficulty? Because you know, it's one of those things, like, you don't want to lose in your Let's Play, but you have to spend so much time thinking about how the fuck to actually win that I ended up spending so much time thinking about it and no time actually playing or writing about it.
Josh, let me have it. I will lose your Let's Play. I will lose in anyone's Great. Let's Play.
And then Oda Nobunaga stepped aside and let his friend Rutskarno step in, and well, everything immediately fell apart after that. We really don't even need to talk about it.
Like, you know why I play Hitman? Like, why I play that on pro difficulty? Like, you know why I always play the games that I don't fully understand? That it's because it's much easier and I'm much more comfortable making myself the punchline than making myself like the all-powerful tour guide showing you how it's done. Like it's always easy to retreat to, oh, look, I don't know what I'm doing. And you know,
The
there's
thing with
that could
watching
be.
you play Hitman, though, is as much as I make fun of you actually do know what you're doing.
Yeah, that's the problem. I do know what I'm doing, so I have to play it on pro difficulty because on pro is the only thing that makes it look like I have no idea. And even then, you know, people in the comments will snipe at like, "Oh, why did you do that? That was stupid." But, you know, if they were actually playing the game, they might just do the same thing.
And
Especially if they were
plus,
talking
really
to Josh at the same time.
playing the way you're supposed to play can be very boring to watch. It's like, okay, the real solution in this situation is to walk in this room and stand here for 2.5 minutes and then follow this idiot into the next room. And it's like, all right, people are watching. I'm not going to do that.
I had kind of, I don't know if it was a moment of weakness, or I forget if it was just that, like, I didn't want to do it, like, I didn't want to throw my head against the wall too many times, but there was one point where I made the mistake. There's one level where I made the mistake of trying to do it the right way, and it involved standing in an elevator shaft, just desperately asking, like, soliciting reader questions for 3 or 4 full minutes each time. And finally, I just decided, why am I doing this? I could pull out an AK and be at in and out. Vip.
Just shoot everyone. That's the obvious correct answer, is shoot everyone. It's a point and click adventure.
It does sort of make you wonder why 47 ever bothered being a silent assassin to begin with. It's like, well, I could sneak into this building, or I could just murder everybody.
Oh, but then he'll get the attention, the notoriety, which I guess has a negative effect on the missions, but really, can you ever actually imagine just like the cop
But
kicking
then
down the
you just have
door
more
and
people
putting
to murder.
47 in handcuffs? Can you
That would
imagine
be pretty
47
funny.
just standing trial in like Tuskegee? Or like in Wichita, just like, oh yeah, we found local cops discovered 47 with unlicensed firearms. We believe he may be connected to 397 murders.
Like they don't even have any evidence to to connect him to the murders. They just give him a misdemeanor for an unregistered firearm. Then he
Just don't.
leaves court, dresses up as one of the judges, and steals his firearms back.
Just don't fly on any airplanes for the next 6 months, 47. Oh, also, fuck you. Anyway, the other game I played was Superhot, which is actually an experimental first-person shooter
Oh,
playable
I
online.
just. That is so cool that you. I just discovered that game today. I haven't played it yet, but I found the trailer and I went all giddy when I saw it. I will link
Yeah,
the
I saw the
trailer in
trailer
the show
yesterday.
notes. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting.
It's like,
So, the
what if
premise
Mirror's
for.
Edge was about shooting people and not about parkour?
So the premise, for those of you who are unaware, is actually that you play a character who time moves very slowly for you, except when you're moving. And it's a shooter like where you have to run up and like knock people down, take their guns, and you know people shoot at you, but the bullets move about this as quickly as softball pitches. So you know you can actually just easily zigzag. Because when you move, you're moving at normal speed. You're not super fast. It's just that time slows down to almost still when you're not actually like zigzagging around. So the thing is, it actually doesn't have as much of an effect on gameplay as you'd think. It really just means
You
it's
know,
slower and kind of easier.
yeah, that's the thing that I thought about it was seeing it is like, so it doesn't actually affect, like, if you were to run this at full time, like real time speed, you wouldn't see you doing any crazy super maneuvers. You just have better reaction times because you can stop and just like think about where the bullets are and then move again a little bit and then stop and then figure out where you're going to move next.
Yeah, it's, I'll tell you what it is. It's a change of pace, you know, very literally speaking. Like, in fact, you know, just blatantly literally speaking. It allows you to sort of, instead of zigzagging around, you know, just being like a fast-paced shooter, it's a little more thoughtful. But, you know, it's not like you have to do any deep thinking. It's just, you know, you can actually sit down and sort of leisurely go through, oh, I think there's a guy over there. So do I want to zigzag around and then let loose a bullet and then zigzag back behind cover? Yeah, okay. And then you do it, and yeah, there's only one level where I actually died at all, and it's just because you're surrounded by enemies. I sort of misestimated and spent too much time moving is the problem. So yeah, I mean, I don't think it's revolutionary. It's not like it challenges the way you think about shooters or what's possible with shooters. It's just kind of an interesting experiment. It's free, of course. You might as well give it a shot.
Yeah, it's less Portal and more, insert somewhat less innovative shooter that's not Portal here.
Well done, Josh.
Yeah, I really thought that one through. I'm pretty proud of myself.
You know, what it actually reminded me of somewhat? And I think some of this may be aesthetics, and some of this may be that I just never understood this game on a very fundamentally deep level. It reminded me of Frozen Synapse, which was the turn-based strategy game where you command soldiers, and where you sort of see predictions of what would happen if you gave certain people certain commands on the turn. And I actually, what I wanted out of that game, and what I didn't realize I wasn't getting until the third or fourth mission, I actually wish that it did a full simulation of the enemy action, and that you could just sort of tinker with it, and because obviously it'd be impossible to lose if you did that. But
like sort of Braid style almost, where you're constantly playing the simulation and rewinding and moving your guys around and seeing what happens.
Yeah, like that would have been a certain kind of rewarding for me. As it is, the simulation is imperfect in that the enemies don't move.
Yeah.
They'll reaction fire if you just move blatantly right in front of them. But they don't, like, you know, enemy movement is not accounted for by the simulation. So you could,
which
you
is
could,
intentional
you can,
since it's entirely versus in multiplayer, isn't it?
It's absolutely. PvP, like, they couldn't do it that way in multiplayer, of course. Yeah, in the single player, the idea is that that's where the challenge comes in, is that, you know, you're getting a prediction that's better than you'd get if you were playing, like, a real-time strategy game. Or if you're playing most turn-based strategy games, like XCOM, like the original XCOM, but it's more data, but it's not comprehensive data.
And that's what you've been playing. Hey, Chris. Hey, Chris.
Hey,
Chris.
What? Hey.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, I'm doing a podcast. Like, I can't talk right now.
Okay.
This is so silly.
Hey, on that podcast, what have you been doing lately? You can tell me.
I've been playing two games this week that I'd want to talk about, and a bunch of detritus that is generic crap that whatever. Game number one I've been playing that I'd like to talk about has been, I played through the entirety of Brothers, that I would highly recommend all of you pick up, all of you here in this room, and also everyone listening. I really, really liked Brothers. It was really good. You do need a controller to play it on the PC, but I like.
Oh, what is it? Can you give us the rundown of what kind of game it is?
So, it's a game where you play as two brothers concurrently, and it's a pretty simple game. You basically play as two brothers in the game space, and one brother is controlled with the left analog stick, and the other brother is controlled with the right analog stick, and then the left and right triggers correspond to the brothers respectively, and as a result you sort of, it's sort of a single-player co-op game where you try to get the two brothers to do what you need them to do to team up and solve all sorts of puzzles at the right time and go to the right place. And they make it interesting by having one brother be older than the other brother. So one brother is younger and smaller and can fit through bars and can do, you know, smaller person things. And the older brother is stronger and can activate lifts and can carry his other brother through water and can pull switches and that sort of thing. And so it's about moving...
To interject here for a second, that kind of sounds like someone was sitting at their desk someday thinking, like, how can I make the draw a counterclockwise circle with your left hand while drawing a clockwise square with your right hand into a video game?
I bet you that there's like an iPhone game where you have to do that. And that's the game.
It sounds like that, but they actually have a lot of different ideas. There's how do you pilot a boat? How do you pilot an airplane like this? How do you solve puzzles when you're connected to one another with a rope? How do you solve puzzles in a more generic dungeon-y sense, like having one brother go on one path and the other brother go on another path? I mean, one of the best things I can say about the game is that it has got a lot of ideas, both for location and for mechanics, and it's that perfect length where it never runs out of ideas and no idea overstays its welcome. Each area is about 20 to 40 minutes long total, and the whole game can be beaten in, I think I beat it in 2.5 hours, but I'm pretty good at those sorts of games, and if you're not super good at figuring out really, really simple puzzles, it can take you, you know, 3-4 hours. But it's a really short game, but it's paced so well in terms of delivering new ideas, new visuals, new content, new mechanics. I don't think I've seen a game paced this well since the first Portal, in terms of just constantly introducing new mechanics and ideas. It's that sort of thing where it's like, introduce a mechanic, toy with the mechanic, okay, that's enough with that mechanic, let's move on, and then occasionally you'll have things that mix it up a bit. And also, it's just...
Well, does it like discard the mechanics, or does it just kind of like inherently incorporate them into what you're doing? Because that was what Portal did, was like... No, you'd go through and you'd like, okay, you got one portal you can place. You got to place it in the right place at the right time so that you can get through the other portal that's moving. And then like, okay, you've got a box. You got to put it on this button. And then after a while, I was like, okay, we got like conveyor belts and stuff.
It builds on it a little bit. Some things are recurring. Things like having the littler brother go through gates and having the bigger brother pull switches come up again and again. Other things, like there's one segment where you fly basically a glider, and you have to you control both brothers, and you need to move them both on the bar of the glider to move your weight to tilt it left and right to turn, and that's only done, I think, in one segment, and it doesn't come back. And so it's a mix of them. Sometimes it's a one-off set piece mechanic. And sometimes it's a thing that comes back, but it's so short that it never feels like it would have room to come back. It's never like, oh man, I totally flew that airplane that one time. They needed to have like 3 more levels of that. It never overstays its welcome, and it very much ends where it needs to end. And I liked it a lot. I would recommend playing it. And then the other thing I've been playing that is perhaps more conversational is at least to Seamus, is Game Dev Tycoon, which is, they make some weird assumptions about how you systemize making a game.
Yes, they do.
Have you played it?
I played, I've only played it for like an hour or so, and it felt weird. In fact, a lot of the assumptions built on into the game felt weird to me about how the audience will respond to a game. It sort of makes these assumptions like, oh, combining these two ideas is a good thing. Combining
right.
This type of game with this type of gameplay is good and this is bad, which is sort of like, means you can only explore what's already been done, and anything that hasn't already been written is an invalid game.
Which is, pretty close to how the games industry operates, but not necessarily how it should operate.
And not probably not what you're looking for when you go into it.
I, I also don't like the way it pits design and technology as opposing forces that add up to a great game. There's not really an idea of a game that's got really good design that stands on its own despite okay technology, and really bad design can be overcome with having some really awesome tech, and there's really no concept of a good game. It's just literally trying to push your tech score as high as possible and your design score as high as possible. Like you need to get really good at both, and they're juxtaposed against one another, and you're not really looking for a quote-unquote good game. You're looking for the most technologically advanced game you can make and the most awesomely designed game you can make, if that makes any sense, which is kind of a weird assumption.
It is kind of weird. Like, you can't... Like, it's an invalid... choice to say, all right, I'm going to hang back at this tech level and just make games that are as fun to play as possible. Because, I mean, a lot of the indie scene right now is dominated by people that, excuse me, that are going back and saying, you know what I loved? I loved games in the 90s, and we don't get those anymore. I want to make more of those. And I think there's a big... There's people that have passion for those old gameplays, and they're saying, you know, I'd love to run a game company that just sort of, instead of rushing forward into 3D games, just like took one type of game and perfected it and nurtured it. And that is not a valid choice to make in this game. You need to be rushing up the tech tree.
Yeah, that's one of the other things. Oh, go ahead, Ritzkern.
It would have been kind of interesting, you know, now as this nuance, to play it as certain industry titans, like to try the Molyneux run, the John Romero run.
Oh, that would be cool.
Mm-hmm. It actually sounds, it kind of reminds me of how they did Hollywood in the game The Movies, which,
yes,
it's kind of interesting how everyone forgot about that existed.
They're similar in that they... Actually, The Movies is arguably better, insofar as this game, making video games is literally filling up bars. You are filling up bars and distributing resources, and then you never see the game, you never see a screenshot, you never create a character, you never have any involvement in anything other than saying, I'm making a ninja game for the fake Sony platform, that has 2D graphics level 2, and I'm naming it Josh's Ninjas, and that's my game. And then you get a little report of the scores after you've made it, saying, it got a 7.0. Yes, Josh's Ninjas.
Ninjas. I need those.
But the point is, like... Okay, go ahead, Josh. Or Retzkarn.
I will say that, like, I wonder how much of this game's success has been predicated upon the, like, the whole anti-piracy thing they included, where they put it on the torrents, but the torrent version, your studio fails because of piracy all the time. Like, that was a pretty genius... If that was a marketing decision, and I have no idea if it was or not, it would have been a pretty genius marketing decision.
It was a masterstroke, it really was.
I mean...
It's why I checked out the game.
I don't like the idea that you're boiling a creative and interesting process down to filling bars, and the movies suffered from this too, because you had to, like, research how to make cowboy movies, just like you have to research how to make cowboy video games. But at least in the movies, you actually got to do a little mini machinima thing that you could export to YouTube. Which, I mean, you made a movie. It's dumb and it's barely functional, but it was making a movie. There's not really a, you can make a crappy little Flash game and export it to Flash here. It's just, hey, remember Josh the video game? It made $4. Yay!
Wait, fuck. Has nobody done a thing where they do a text Let's Play the Movies, and then they just have a YouTube channel where they upload the actual films?
Someone should do that. Josh?
I want to fucking do that. Do I have the... I don't have the discs anymore. Can you buy it anywhere? Like, anywhere?
No, it doesn't exist anymore. I've looked. There are copies on, like, eBay and Amazon.
Didn't the studio that do it, like, fold or something like that?
It was the Peter Molyneux studio, with the Lions something-something.
Oh, that'll explain that why it looked really cool and ended up being really disappointing.
Didn't Lionhead fold? I don't... Or was it just that Molyneux left? I don't remember.
It folded. It did fold, eventually.
Yeah. See? Gaming trivia. I know it. I don't know why I'm celebrating. That kind of sucks. I mean,
the movie is actually is not going for Peter that much Molyneux money.
Studio,
I was
but at the same time. I'm sorry. I'm going to stop monologuing here so you can talk.
I'm just saying that the movies is surprisingly cheap, given that it's a comparatively rare PC game. It is going right now on Amazon for about $30 to $45, which is way cheaper than Operation Genesis was going for last time I tried to pick it up on the PC.
Yeah, but honestly, $30 is more than I'd be willing to spend on the movies for anybody, for any fucking Let's Play.
Yeah, really.
For comparison, the Jurassic Park Operation Genesis is going for $199 on the PS2 and $600 for the Windows machine. So,
four. Yep. That's a pretty good argument for fucking piracy right there.
Yeah, but like, you gotta like break the law to do that, man. Are you gonna like risk John Hammond suing you?
I've always kind of considered games that are either abandonware or not being sold anywhere anymore, like in any capacity, where if you bought the game from anyone, you would actually be able to get money into the developer's hands or whoever owns its hands. If that doesn't exist, like if there's no link to the people who own it or nobody owns it, then I, you know, what the hell, why not?
You say that,
but stuff appears on GOG all the time, and like Steam.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, look at what happened to System Shock, where for like 10 years it was in limbo, and then suddenly somebody found the rights.
But people love the shit out of the X-Wing series, and you still cannot buy it anywhere.
You're never going to be able to buy it again. Come on, let's be honest.
I guess that's his point. And, you know, I think the argument is...
an HD remake of TIE Fighter. That's all I want you got. I can retire after that.
Yeah, and I think the argument is more complicated than that, but I can certainly... It certainly starts to look a lot blurrier when you're talking about paying $40 for the fucking movies.
But you can make crappy, like, lo-fi SD 140p or whatever movies, like, with no voice acting.
So is there a technological reason why you couldn't just queue up the Sims-style commands according to some kind of schedule and film that instead of using their 10 pre-canned animations? I think we've had this debate before.
It wasn't a very good video game. I would suppose is probably the technological reason you couldn't do that.
A full-on machinima tool would be very expensive and different from what we ended up with, which was a crappy tycoon game stapled on, or that had machinima tools stapled onto it, awkwardly.
I suppose this all goes back to, like, how do you systemize the creative process of making a video game anyway? I mean, you're at some point going to have to delete it down to numbers and stuff. And making video games is hard, is the other thing. Like, it's easy to, like, make a fake movie comparatively to making a video game.
No, but, like, if you're already limiting people to genres and archetypes, why can't I choose from a number of pre-different animated sprites and then choose from a number of pre-different, like, palette swaps for them and have generic enough subject matters where I can have, you know, a tree that's pink or a tree that's red or a tree that's green and then that sort of thing, where I can choose a color tone and a basic mechanic set and say, here's my game. It's a 2D shooter where you play Mario who he runs sideways and shoots dudes.
I don't know. You know, I feel like that might be like, might just come off as just like a novelty. Like, you play it once, and then it's like, okay, I've basically seen everything you can possibly do with this tool. I'm just going to skip this stuff and just play it as a tycoon game.
How about this? Like, instead of actually making a game, which is a huge technological issue, even if you do a bunch of stock genres that are really simple, like 2D shooters, how about, instead of that, you do a really simple clip art thing that lets you design the cover for the game. That way you feel like you've expressed yourself and you can make a cover for a game that you can imagine the game of for it, or you can just click auto-generate and it just here's a character and a guy.
Yeah. That's what I was
thinking.
Here's
a white guy with a stubborn goatee holding a gun while a spaceship explodes behind him.
That's what I found really unsatisfying is that I didn't get a box I couldn't design or just have one auto-generated, like, here is the thing that you made. And I really felt like that's what I wanted to kind of close the deal when I finished a game, is I wanted to see, okay, you made the product, and here it is.
God, that's
a box.
Yeah. That's the other thing, is the review scores you get. The game places an absurd emphasis on review scores, such that the game sort of, like, pauses and says, hey, your review scores are in, and instead of just giving you a summary page of your review scores, it, like, ticks them up like it's a deal or no-deal thing, like, tick, 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 and it's a random number every time until it gets to the actual number of the review, and then it does this for, like, 6 reviews. Like, you get 4 scores, and every single one of them is like, it could be a 7, it could be a 2, it could be a 7, it could be a 9, it could be an 8, it could be a 2, it could be a 1, and it's a 6. Which, by the way, is the thing, another thing, you get 6s really, it's hard to make a good game in that game. You're either making 6s, or you're making 6s. Like, there's very rarely that you end up with...
Is the 6 an objective rating, is the 6 an objective rating, or is that weighted for video game reviewing, lol, 6 at 7-point scale?
They don't actually weight to 7 to 10. They actually use the whole scale here, which is actually kind of a weird thing, because I'm used to...
You would think that would be the easiest cheap commentary they could make by, like,
right.
Your game got awful reviews, 7 out of 10.
Well, that's the thing, is that this is one dimension where the movies, which, you know, I have a lot of concerns with as a video game, but where the movies actually got ahead a little bit, was that their simulation was ultimately no less reductionist. I mean, you know, you were picking the costumes, and you were, in theory, like, making your little movies, or you could just turn out a script mill and not give a shit. But, you know, at the end of the day, you're still like, okay, I need a young, attractive actor for my romance film, because romance films are hot right now, and I need it out in the next 3 months. And it, you know, it was very, very, like, just by the numbers. But that was sort of the point. It's kind of like a satire of Hollywood, is that, you know, you're not, you can't be an auteur filmmaker, you know, you're not, like, you have this tiny little studio and, like, an 8mm camera. No, you have a giant studio lot. Like, you know, you come to work in a limousine. It's supposed to be that you're just playing the numbers game.
And maybe the movies did it better. It's been years since I've played the movies, and I can't really remember whether it did or didn't. But Seamus tapped on this earlier, but I think that's one of the core failings of both the movies and Game Dev Tycoon, and that's the idea that it's designed to be won, and by winning, you become the biggest and the best, and that means becoming Activision. Like, the arc of the game is you start in the 80s as a lone game dev in your garage making, you know, crappy little... one-dimensional, one-color, monochrome video games, and by the end of the game, you're effectively an Activision dev studio that's subcontracted to a publisher and making millions of dollars a year, and you're super famous. But there's no room to become, like, to become satisfied with the idea that, hey, I make middle-of-the-road pretty good games, or I'm a small studio that makes artsy stuff. None of that happens. It's the goal is become Activision, or the goal is become Universal Studios or Disney in the movies.
Yep. Yeah. And if it was more sandboxy, where it didn't have that, that goal, that was how you win, was becoming the biggest. If you kind of decided your own, if it had multiple goals that were somehow conflicting, like, you know, turn out some way of, like, turning out games with super high review scores, which would mean just really, really polishing the gameplay, or just really pleasing a particular genre, you know, being like one of those strategy, like being a series that just really focuses, like, oh, we're going to ignore all the current trends, and we're just making turn-based strategies because that's our passion. That kind of thing. If there were goals there for people that wanted to focus on particular kinds of games or genres.
And that's
or
actually,
being
I think,
an auteur, yeah.
And that's actually, I think, not to bring up our famous recurring whipping boy on the show, but that's one of the problems that plagues the recent SimCity, where traditional SimCities were happy with, like... Well, no, seriously, like, traditional SimCities were interested in letting you make an agrarian city, like a self-sustaining farm country, or you know, a small town that... you know, would see impacts of taxes that would echo throughout the whole system. Like, if you raise commercial tax and that closes half of the commercial area in town, that was a big deal to an agrarian farm town that had only a few zones of commercial. But in a in SimCity 2013 or 2012, whenever it came out, the point of the game is to basically make a megatropolis. That's what the entire thing is designed to do. That's why all the algorithms are there.
A megatropolis that is 2 kilometers across on a side.
Yes.
Well, yes, it's the size thing is ridiculous, but the point is, I mean, you've seen the bum town or whatever that has nothing but housing.
Yes,
I can't remember
Libertopia.
The name of it.
Libertopia. It's called Libertopia.
But you've seen Libertopia. The whole idea is that eventually you end up with just skyscrapers everywhere. That's the goal of the game, and all of the algorithms are slanted to push you in that direction. There's no, like, self-sustaining small town. It's you start small and you grow up into huge. And it just sort of assumes systemically, both the movies and Game Dev Tycoon and SimCity sort of assume that you want that. You want to become Activision. You want to become New York City. You want to become Disney Studios. You want to become the biggest thing you possibly could become. Because that means you win, and it's a really weird... I understand why you do it to give the player a sense of progression, but at the same time, it results in a game that has this really weird worldview that says the biggest is the best, and your goal is to become that.
And it sort of discourages a lot of the creativity. You might, like, anything creative or unexpected becomes invalid, because, hey, that doesn't lead to victory.
Imagine if Minecraft basically pushed you towards getting the diamond hat, diamond armor, diamond sword, diamond pickaxe or whatever. Like, if the game was designed to push you towards that, instead of saying, make whatever and do your thing. Because that's really what it is. It's pushing you down this progress meter. And some games that's legitimate for, like I think Diablo, obviously, is designed from the ground up to facilitate you becoming, like, an amazing warrior covered in super rare orange armor that is, like, totally rare and one of a kind. But the movies, or these other things that are supposed to be creative and expressive, pushing you down a linear path of progress that just means you're bigger and have more money is kind of a weird way to approach it. Anyway, I've gone on for too long. Josh, what have you been playing?
Amnesia came out last Tuesday. The new one, Amnesia Machine for Pigs. And I haven't gotten too far into it, so I don't want to say this is, like, definitely my final impressions of the game, but I don't really like it that much. It's not awful, but...
Would I pee my pants is the question everyone wants to know.
Well, you almost peed your pants when we did the Slender episode, so... which
don't spoil that. That's not going to post yet. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Are we going to have to censor you, John?
I mean, that's kind of like a low bar there. No, we're not. I'm not going to... I don't need to be censored. That's ridiculous. You know, I'm not 100% sure whose fault it is, but I kind of want to chalk the changes up to having the game being developed by the Chinese Room, who did Dear Esther, who, as you know, are kind of, like, hostile to traditional gameplay mechanics. So, there's no resources, no inventory. No, the only thing that you actually have access to is just journal. You know, you don't pick up tinder boxes to light things anymore. You don't require oil for your lantern. You don't have inventory puzzles. You don't have, like, even use key on door puzzles, really. The only puzzles in the game that I've run into so far are pick up an object and hover it in front of your face, gravity gun style, and then walk over to the place where the object is supposed to go, and then put the object into it, and then do whatever you have to do with the object that now has the object in it.
They Bioshock Infinite-ed it?
Kinda, yeah.
You know, I'll go ahead and say, though, like, I've this is just how I felt about it, but in the first Amnesia, I felt like the fact that your lantern attracts enemies was disincentive enough to use it. Like, I felt like the tinderboxes and the oil was more stressful than scary. Like, it didn't increase the tension as far as, oh, no, like, I'm feeling this sort of, this is fun. It was more like, do I want to use my lantern?
It didn't
I don't know.
Add.
I got tons of oil, but maybe I shouldn't. Maybe there won't be any oil in the next level.
Yeah, by the end of the game, I had so many tinderboxes,
much oil.
Okay,
there's also no sanity mechanic anymore. You don't go insane for being in the dark. There's not, none of that is in the game. There's not even any a health mechanic anymore, as far as I can tell. I mean, you can die, but you don't have health potions. You don't have the ability to check how much health you have. You don't have, there is literally none of the systems that were in Amnesia aside from walk around and interact with stuff with your mouse. So in that respect, it does feel kind of like Dear Esther. Which would not be a massive problem if it weren't for the fact that the game feels more linear than it did before. Like, I mean, Amnesia was never, like, super open or anything, but you had, like, series of hub levels where you'd come to this room and you'd look around in the side rooms and find stuff and piece together, you know, whatever you need to get through the door to go to the next hub level, while also learning about what was happening in this area of the castle. There's none of that in this game. You barely spend any time in any one area. It's usually just like, how do I find my way through this maze of doors to get to the next room? It really feels a lot more like I'm in a theme park. Like I'm being led along through a Disney haunted house. I was like, okay, here's this room. You see the drawer full of teeth in the desk over there, and there's it's a factory, and oh look, there's a door that has a monster behind it that's breaking through it. Now please move to the next room. Let's go on. You're scared now. Let's go. It doesn't feel like they put very much effort into
scripted.
Making it seem like it's a real place. It feels very, very, very hand-holdy for what it's doing. Like, you know, it's like very obvious. Like, okay, here's the part where you're supposed to be scared. Okay, you're scared. Now you have to go over to this thing and put this fuel tank into this car and then crank it so you can open the door and then go forward. And it's... you know, I don't know. It still has scary moments, but it seems a bit diminished because it feels fake. Like, part of the thing that made Amnesia so good was it had this veneer of realism to it, where it felt like, okay, I'm actually in this broken down abandoned castle. I mean, another example of this is the game has this really fucking annoying blue haze filter over everything. So even when you're in well-lit areas, it doesn't look well-lit. It looks like you're wearing, like, old man sunglasses around everywhere. And I know they were going like, oh, we gotta make it artsy and stuff. I'm like, you're not safe even when you're in nice, well-lit areas and the monsters could jump out in any second. But, you know, the thing with Amnesia was there were areas where you felt really in danger, and there were areas where you felt safe. And the cool part was when it started to subvert those things where, you know, it's... the very first point where you run into a monster, where you run into one of the servants, not the water monster, in Amnesia, where it can actually kill you, is in a well-lit room. You know, and the fact that nothing feels well-lit or safe in the game kind of makes me feel like just the whole game is this samey, you know, dark haunted house. It feels... fake. So I don't know. I'm not very far into it, but then again, that's another thing, is that like I've had it for about a week now and I haven't played that much of it because I don't feel like it's really grabbing me like the other game did, so that's not great. But you know, maybe maybe I'll get to a point where the game starts to pick up and really get some steam going, and then it'll actually be a good Amnesia experience. I don't know. But right now, not having the greatest time with it.
That makes me sad. I've been looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody's kind of been looking forward to it.
I mean, I should emphasize, it's not, like, awful. It's not shit. It's not slender.
Right, but it's not the... But it's not quite... the high water mark that the original was.
Are you saying you did not appreciate Slender, Josh? Integral. Oh, come on! Slender is run around in a dark forest for 20 minutes looking for inexplicable crayon drawing stuff about the Slender Man because for no reason. You're not ever given a reason why you're running around through the forest looking for these things.
Investigative journalism!
A completely unanimated character model pops in and out randomly, and if you're near enough to it, you die.
You know, can I pursue your other idea of putting a monster, just one monster, in Dear Esther, please? Dear Esther, I found a photograph today. The edges were cold and worn, much like my soul has been... Oh, God!
You know, I liked Dear Esther... Like, I didn't hate Dear Esther. I don't want to give that impression that I thought Dear Esther was, like, some awful thing, because it wasn't, because it didn't have any video game hooks. But I liked Dear Esther a lot more before I figured out what was going on, and before I knew that I was safe.
Right, when you didn't know what you were up against, and when you thought that you could be attacked or whatever. Yes, it was so much more interesting then once you really realized, oh, there's not much going on here at all. This is random crap being said.
That was actually the first thing I realized when I played Dear Esther. Maybe that's why I never finished it. It's like 30 minutes long.
I liked it. I liked it a lot. I thought it was a noble... Okay, put it this way. It was a worthy experiment. I do not think you could support... I don't think this is a genre that could support a lot of different games. I think this is an idea. The idea was completed, and we're done. Maybe there's room for one more. But I don't think the complete tourist approach to game design, where there's no threat, nothing to overcome, no goal, and where it doesn't seem to have much to say at the end of it. I don't think that's a very deep...
Yeah, I mean... Okay, yeah. I was actually about to talk about Gone Home.
Gone Home had a lot
Gone
to
Home
say,
had a lot of mechanics. It also had a lot of mechanics compared to Dear Esther.
Here's the thing. Because Dear Esther, to me, as an English major, really pissed me off. Because I'm an English major and because I have to deal with stuff like this. I'm not actually angry at Dear Esther, right? I don't actually hate it. But I didn't find it very engaging because I felt like it was exploring environments without really engaging with them. I feel like it was looking at things without really having anything that, like, pushes back or makes you think much. And the narration was, you know, is random enough and cryptic enough and, you know, ultimately doesn't really... There's nothing really to get. You know, you can form impressions from
it. The interesting thing about Dear Esther, the narration is actually randomized. The story changes every time you play it.
Yeah, how far did you get, Rutskarn?
I got to the end of the glowing tunnels.
Okay, so you almost beat it. You were about 10
you
minutes
almost,
from it,
basically. Yeah.
I
there's
really
actually
liked
like
it,
a
but
problem.
Like
my computer overheated or something, and I just elected not to finish it.
This is a recurring theme with you.
The first time I played through the game, I actually really didn't like it. I thought it was pretty boring. There was nothing going on. It's once I played through it two or three times and the story really started taking shape, and also the branches in the story started taking shape, that I really started to dig what it was doing. And I think you have to, like, invest two or three playthroughs and actually pay attention to what's being said. And once you do that, it's a more literary, engaging experience for what it's doing. But it is such an acquired taste, and it requires so much effort on behalf of the player that
It's short enough that I might actually take you up on that. I might actually give that a shot.
Yeah. I mean, I don't hate Dear Esther, like I said. you know, I liked it for what it was. I think Gone Home is objectively a better version of Dear Esther in basically every way.
Yeah,
Gone Home is the contrast. It's the same exploring, but every step, every second, like, you're engaging with something. You're engaging with an object, or you're engaging with a direct narration.
Yeah, Dear Esther is almost, like, oblique for the sake of it. Like, it makes, like, no sense through most of the narrative, almost because it wants to make no sense, which... I mean, I guess you could make an argument for that being an interesting way to do it, but
even the island itself is this sort of abstract symbol. I mean, you could debate whether or not you're even alive when the game starts, and whether or not you're in some sort of weird purgatory of self-destruction. It's a really weird, obtuse game, and you do have to like sort of want to like it to like it. If you don't want to like it, you will never like it. It is a very obtuse game that hides everything important about it from the player. And that kind of sucks.
I certainly wanted to like it. It felt a little modernist. Like, it felt like rather than having something expressing...
It is very, very post-modernist.
It felt like it had something that it was... it felt like it wanted to be what it was. And you can interpret that how you like. You know, you walk into, you know, it's very much like you walk into a house, there's some, like, empty paint cans, there's some books lying around. What does that mean? I don't know. What does that mean? You decide.
Yeah, it is dripping with postmodernism. It is the most postmodernist game I've ever played.
No, that's Saints Row. Saints Row is extremely postmodern. I think Rutskarn's right. I think it's a very modernist game. It's a very formalist game. It is a game that wants you to take what is there on its own terms and not really look beyond the fourth wall or look for any comparison. It's not a commentary on genre. It's not asking what symbols themselves are or mean. It is a symbol, and that's supposed to be taking, I don't want to say literally, but literally as a symbol. It is, the island is what it is in the game's universe.
Yeah, I have no idea how many people this will mean anything to, because I've spent so much time hanging around people, like, in sort of a humanities echo chamber that I was happy to be free of. But it's the kind of game that Gertrude Stein would write.
I like
Stein. He's the guy who did Goosebumps, right? Yeah.
Yeah! Yeah, Gertrude Stein.
Well played.
Sinister Button.
So that's how I think Amnesia is. Total War Rome 2. I've been playing some more of that. As much crap as I give Creative Assembly last week for the awful, awful launch, and maybe I should direct some of that at Sega, because I'm almost certain that Sega had a massive hand in it. And in fact, looking at it, it seems more like everybody else, like everybody on the Creative Assembly team, is just as mad about the launch as we are. So, you know, but I gotta hand it to them; they are patching faster than I've seen anyone try to fix a broken launch before. They've done two massive patches now. Well, one of them is a beta patch, but by the time this goes up, it'll probably be out. It's fixed a number of things. Like when the game came out, I didn't even really talk about this, but the campaign AI was super passive. Like, I could play a game on very hard and never get war declared on me, and just like be able to just sit around and wait until I build up my forces and then declare war on everyone and just sweep the map, which I was in the process of doing before I said, I don't really want to play a game where I can just push over all the AI. It didn't recruit units properly. Like, it would just recruit a whole bunch of peasants and peasant slingers and send like seven of those guys in an army and suicide it against your walls over and over again. So it was really, really broken. Like, in comparison to Shogun 2, where if I screw up on a very hard game or a legendary game, like, I'm in very real danger of losing. In this game, it was like, oh, I guess I'll spend the next five turns building a new army so I can kill even more of them. They've kind of fixed that now. The AI seems a bit more aggressive and a bit less stupid on the campaign map anyway. So and they've made a bunch of fixes to the performance and to the graphics and some other like miscellaneous UI stuff. They're starting to work on balance even. So it's cool to see them doing all that. But the game is still hilariously buggy. Like, so there's like, I think 13 wonders of the world or 11 wonders of the world or whatever, like the pyramids, you know, the Hanging Gardens, Babylon, Stonehenge, and so on. But, and you can see them on the campaign map, but what you're supposed to be able to do is if you go into a battle on the campaign map while standing next to one of those wonders, you're supposed to actually like have it on the battle map that you can see somewhere. Which is cool and all. You can do that for the pyramids just fine. The pyramids show up. But if you do that for, like, say, Stonehenge, I saw a screenshot of this yesterday. Guy did a battle next to Stonehenge. Stonehenge isn't there, but you can see where it's supposed to be, because instead of Stonehenge, there's a massive square hole in the ground that leads to the water table.
Like, the water table's actually modeled in, like, the game?
Well, I mean, there's water, you know, in case there's, like, a lake or something. You got the water plane. Well, where Stonehenge is supposed to be, there's a big, like, 200-meter-wide square hole through the level that goes down to the water, and that's all that there is for where Stonehenge is supposed to be.
Historians are missing a few facts about Stonehenge.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that it was once the portal to hell, that seems pretty relevant.
And this is the case for every single wonder in the game except the pyramids right now. Is they're all just square block holes in the level, like somebody had a problem rendering a Minecraft quad.
Or you go on a server where someone had way too much time on their hands.
Yeah.
You know, it's actually kind of interesting, because when you said that Creative Assembly was just as angry, it seems like they might have been just as angry as anyone else. I was actually surprised when I first heard that Rome had so many glitches, because Creative Assembly has never struck me as the sort of people who make, like, games so, you know, they can sell units, they can make it for Christmas. Creative Assembly always struck me, and it even struck me as the kind of people who just, you know, make games because they love making games, they love making perfect games. They strike me as the sorts of people who really like playing Total War games, and so they make Total War games because otherwise nobody would make Total War games.
Yeah, that's definitely true, but ever since they were picked up by Sega, pretty much since Empire came out, they've been having pretty bad launches. I mean, even Shogun 2 had a pretty awful launch. Bugs were more localized to the multiplayer side of things, which was understandable because they were doing a bunch of stuff they'd never done before, but you had funny shit where you would, like, be in a custom battle. Like, you'd go to, like, a custom battle room where you'd set up the lobby, and you'd go, like, okay, I want to switch to the other team. So you'd hit the switch team button, and you would switch the team, and then the slot that was on the other team would come with you. So you could get weird stuff where you'd go, like, 4-0, and the host couldn't fix it, and you'd have to remake the game.
You know, the best moment of any TF2 server would be when matchmaking would break and you could do weird stuff like that.
And the really greatest thing about that bug is that it's in Rome 2 and I can still do it after 3 fucking years. But yeah, so Rome 2 is being fixed. So, you know, hopefully soon it will enter to the point where I can say, yeah, you should probably buy this if you like Total War games. It's not there yet. Don't do it yet. You'll be disappointed, but it's getting there.
All right, I think that's actually about all we have time for.
We had all this other stuff to talk about, but we've been going for like 2 hours now, and I think Seamus actually fell asleep. Like, he's not answering anymore. There he is.
No,
yeah.
I'm here. I'm just leaning back. I don't have anything to say about War II Total Rome. I don't strategy game with that.
But, like, Frank Miller wrote that comic about how they defended that column or that area, and then all the Persians showed up.
Oh, yeah, I read that. That was really historically accurate.
Yeah.
And they were totally Romans in that comic, too. Yeah.
And they captured the flag, just like Josh said they would.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Romans, tonight, we dine somewhere, like in the enemy's base Hades. After we conquered from them. There you go.
Is it Hades in Roman, though? I think it's...
I don't believe it's Hades.
Everything.
That's probably...
Heaven forbid we fucking get anything wrong.
Oh my
god,
I just realized Tonight We Dine in Hell makes no sense, because they would totally be talking about Hades.
They would also totally be talking in ancient Greek.
Oh my god, Gerard Butler wasn't alive when that movie was supposed to take place.
What? You saying Gerard Butler isn't a Highlander?
So the counterpoint to that argument, Josh, is that they don't refer to each other as Josh and Frank and Steven. Hey, Steve, you want to go to the kegger? And by kegger, you mean Spartan orgy? Yes, that is what I mean.
Oh. So, okay, Hades is actually the Greek god of the underworld, not the underworld itself. So...
Okay. You know,
I think they just said the underworld.
I guess, yeah.
They had a name for it, right?
Good night.
It was. Damn it! Don't end with my embarrassment. You can't do that.
So the actual answer is that they had different names for different kinds of underworld.
Your mom's underworld.
Nerd.